gold is indestructible. You can blow it up, and what you will effectively do is you will turn it into gold dust. But it's not that it will suddenly, you know, change into something else. You can destroy it in a sense of blowing it to pieces, but at a molecular level, it cannot be destroyed. And do you remember when your parents gave you your lunch money, for example? Do you remember maybe if your parents said like, oh, you know, spend as much as you want, as much as you need, and just give us the rest, right? What that reminds me of is a budget that maybe your local or national government has. Because if you consider that inflation is on 2% per year, let's assume for the sake of argument that it is only 2%, then unless year on year you don't earn 2% more, you're earning less in real terms year on year. And that's just the supposed target inflation. And of course, hello and welcome to WS Podcast. My name is Wojciech Salski, I'll be your host for today. And before we begin, may I just remind you, if you haven't already, and you think it's worth it, I believe it is, please make sure to follow, subscribe, you know, click that button that allows you to see what's up with the new episodes. And if you'd like to support the podcast by sharing it with your friends and maybe on your social media, that's also amazing. And if you'd like to support the podcast in any other way, there are ways out there. Just follow the link below for those. There are some developments in the background, so this might switch in the coming weeks or months. But for now, the links are always there for you, and I deeply appreciate it. You know, it helps the podcast to grow. It helps me to address a bigger audience, and it lets me know as well every now and then, especially if you email me directly, which some of you do, for which I'm incredibly grateful, that I'm doing a good job, and that really means a lot. So yeah, make sure to click that follow, subscribe, or whatever button. Now, here we are, the end of the season, although, you know, in the meantime, we've had so many interviews that it might seem like there was no season. There seemed to be a season within a season, if you think about it. But I don't really treat conversations as part of a themed season. You know, some of those conversations that you might have observed over the weeks recently, over the months really, were more related to what we've discussed over the season, some of them slightly less. You know, for example, the conversation I had with Paul on Capital Offense, his book, and, you know, his perspective on the way economy is these days, that's certainly something up the street of the season, you know, surrounding economy and finance and macroeconomics and a little bit of politics and global sort of outlook and history. And it's definitely related to the topic of today's show. But also some other episodes might have been about other stuff. You know, we've had people from all walks of life, and some of the conversations were really, really informal. Some of them were a bit more structured and professional. But yeah, I hope you enjoyed. I certainly did, and I'm already, I have plenty of more interviews lined up, so this is going to be coming up as we speak. And in terms of the next season, let's see, but we are here right now on the final episode of the season dedicated to books related to finance, economy, and so forth. And so today, I'd like to discuss with you a book which I listened to in an audio form, so I don't have anything to raise here and show you. Secret History of Gold by Dominic Frisby. And I will mention straight away that first and foremost, that book is amazing. It's really, really fun. And if you don't know much about gold, apart from, oh, that's the thing that everyone seems to like, and, you know, maybe some people have it, or maybe some people wear it, there is plenty of fun facts, and I'm gonna throw some at you today. And also, I would encourage you to check out the book, so I'll put the link below for it. But also, I've encountered the Dominic Frisbee series on Bitcoin and energy on the What is Money show, which I'll link below as well, because I think it is very, very informative, and there are many, you know, relatable parts of that series. And I initially listened to the series similarly to the Sailor series of that same show, and only recently have I finally gotten to listen to the book, and I enjoyed it wholeheartedly. So I think there is not a better book to finish the season with. We've started with it's gonna be like a little nice circle, really, because we've started with The Price of Tomorrow by Jeff Booth, and the book which was essentially dedicated to the idea that the natural state of free market is deflation, and so what we experience inflation like is not natural, it's man-made, and it's not necessarily positive. We might explore that, but today we'll discuss the secret history of gold, and I have three main themes I'd like to explore today. One will simply be entertainment. There will be some fun facts I'll throw at you and have you thinking. Then we will discuss the difference between, you know, money that is printing money essentially out of thin air versus sort of, I guess, hard money that you need to exert energy to produce. And then I will offer you some practical ideas, applications potentially, to consider, right? This is simply educational. I'm no advisor. It's none of my business what you do with your wealth, your money, but I'll simply share what I've experienced, and maybe I'll reflect as well on a little bit on my journey up to this point, simply for your own benefit, as I know many of you are in a similar situation in terms of your age and, you know, your I believe outlook on life. Otherwise you wouldn't be listening to me conversing and rambling on these things. So I hope that this can be of value to you. So let's start with the fun facts, right? And some of the more fun ones that I found in the book. So one of the first really, really beautiful ideas that I actually have a quote written down somewhere, I'll share with you in a bit, is this idea that according to the author, gold is as old as our planet, or even more. So it's one of those things that one of those elements that is just there, right? And apparently it's also to be found extraterrestrially, as you can say, and so the author early on in the book makes this point that whenever you touch gold, you know, let's say I have my wedding ring here, and supposedly it's gold of some sort. The author says that whenever you touch gold, you are the closest to touching eternity, because it's been here longer than you were, and it will be here longer than you will be. Unless something drastically changes and we become immortal. What's really fun as well, on top of that, is that gold cannot be destroyed. So even though gold might be used in technological applications that potentially, for example, you know, gold is being used as part of majority of some, you know, technologies out there, microchips and that. Your phone, your laptop has, they both have a slight amount of gold in them. And the fun thing about it is that it cannot be destroyed, right? Similarly to energy, if you think about it, if you remember the, I believe that it's the second law of thermodynamics, that energy is not destroyed, it's simply transmuted, it's changed. And so similarly, gold is indestructible. You can blow it up, and what you will effectively do is you will turn it into gold dust. But it's not that it will suddenly, you know, change into something else. You can destroy it in a sense of blowing it to pieces, but at a molecular level, it cannot be destroyed. And so a big fun fact that the author shares with us is that effectively, you don't know if you are wearing any gold on you, you don't know who wore on use or used or touched that gold before. Who knows, maybe that same bracelet that you're wearing right now is made of the same gold that Cleopatra had in her palace. And then, you know, over the different generations, it was robbed, stolen, passed on, and whatever, misplaced. So it's a really, really fun thing to ponder, right? And it, for me, I'm certainly very interested in, you know, the whole idea of why are we here and what is this existence really about? What is this universe? I find it fascinating that, you know, you're essentially, whenever you're interacting with gold, and maybe this is one of the reasons why we're so fascinated by it. Of course, there are some theories there, but I think this is as good as any. Maybe within us, there is a certain level of resonance with this eternal-like substance, you know? So, for example, the Incas thought that gold was essentially the tears of the sun. Funnily enough, you know, back in the day, when only seven base metals were considered metals, because some of them in liquid form at the time were not considered to be metals just yet, they were portrayed as seven celestial bodies in our solar system, for example. So as Incas believed that gold was tears of the sun, gold was represented by the sun, and silver was represented by the moon, you know? So it's really, really, for example, I think Jupiter was represented by, Jupiter was representing copper, funnily, you know, obviously because of the color and stuff. So it's really interesting as a concept that, you know, the sun is obviously the most important thing for the planet in terms of, you know, being able to do all kinds of wonderful things. And good luck trying to get by without sun for many days. You know how it feels when you've not seen a sun for a while. It's essential for our existence. Similarly to the air we breathe and the water we drink. And so it's quite a telling, interesting fact to recognize that people associated sun with gold, right? How beautiful must gold be for us, objectively, it seems, to be considered, you know, related or somehow relevant to the most important celestial body apart from the Earth in our system. Now, apparently, and this is also really, really fun, I don't know if you remember, but back in the day, we've done a bunch of episodes about Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and then we did the Seven Spiritual Laws of Success by Deepak Chopra. And we talked about Sanskrit, right? So one of the more ancient languages, a very beautiful one. And so in Sanskrit, gold is javal. I hope I'm not butchering the word. And this is where gold as a word came from, for us, because jawal means to shine. You can recognize obviously jewelry as a related word with that. So, you know, obviously humans tend to describe things as we see them or as we hear them or as we taste them. And so gold as something that shines is has been with us for so long. Now, maybe coming slightly more towards the relevant stuff in terms of, you know, our analysis of what this means for us. Why is he talking about gold? Like, I don't need gold these days. I just have a couple of pounds in my pocket and I'm all good. So there is this funny, I think, anecdote. I'm not so sure if it's true. The author mentioned it as well, but I'm not, you know, don't quote me or the author as this is the truth. But I don't know if you remember the Golden Rule. So the Golden Rule, as known in a sort of cultural, I guess, spiritual, religious tone, is this rule that do unto others as you wish to be done unto yourself, right? So don't treat others the way you wouldn't want to be treated. I believe it's a golden rule simply because it's a good rule to follow, you know? But, you know, this is not a discourse on morality or ethics. It's up to you to decide. Now, apparently, Alexander the Great, I don't know if you know about Alexander the Great. If you don't and you want to explore this, please do. He was a Macedonian king, I guess, ruler, who effectively conquered a major part of the ancient world at the time. His empire's sort of spanned from Greece to India, or even slightly further from what I remember. And funnily enough, because of the amount of gold in circulation and coinage that he introduced to his, you know, to his empire, coinage meaning creating, you know, mining, minting coins with his sort of face on them to represent him as the authority figure in that trade system. Apparently, there were so many coins in circulation and also so many people under his rule at the time that the author, you know, jokes that he was effectively the first sort of, his was the first gold standard, a global trade gold standard, simply because it spanned so much. So what he claims about the golden rule, and this is an anecdote, I don't know if it's for sure the truth, but it's said that he said, he who has the gold makes the rules. That's the golden rule. So, you know, just sort of alluding here to begin with, you might observe that, especially as you delve deeper into this book, that over the centuries, at least the ones that we've been taught about, and supposedly we know more about them than, you know, many centuries past, gold played a huge, very important role in as a backbone, as a foundation to trade and wealth creation and wealth maintenance. And, you know, for example, a fun fact about aqueducts in ancient Rome. I live in the UK. I know that this is the case for majority of Europe as well. You go across Europe and you see those beautiful aqueducts that were built in the Roman times and they still stand, right? They are a testament to the ingenuity and architectural genius of those people. Now, I always thought, and that's what I was told in school, that aqueducts were used in Rome to provide water to crops, right? To areas that couldn't, you know, be easily watered. At least that was the narrative. Now, according to the author, that's completely false. And it is as simple as aqueducts were built. There were primarily the Romans needed to provide water to the mines. And that's especially the case in Spain, which was a huge mining operation for the Roman Empire, apparently having like 270 mines in one region. Please read the book for more details on that. So effectively what the Romans sort of invented was a way of mining gold by first warming up the mined wall to a very high temperature, and then rapidly cooling it by pouring water over it from the aqueduct. And what this created is this shock, a temperature shock that caused the rocks to burst, to break, and they were easily dislocated from, and then obviously mined. So quite a fun little fun fact there for you. So next time you hear someone, maybe during your tourist visit to Italy or Spain, telling you that these are the aqueducts that were used to provide water to the crops, maybe don't be that person and call the poor tourist guide out, but maybe just whisper afterwards to your friends that not necessarily, according to some people and some sources, it was actually because of the mining industry, because gold was really, really important for the Roman Empire. Effectively, what the Roman Empire's business model, if you will, was, and this I assume you know, is the empire, you know, continued conquering new lands, bringing all the wealth or the gold into Rome, effectively into the capital, reminting it, so you know, pouring it all into one cauldron and making coins out of it, and then paying in those coins to their soldiers, and effectively, you know, to the whole of the empire. So it was like a machine for funding more of the conquest. And of course, morally, ethically, this is not for us to decide, but in terms of practical application, this model certainly worked. And it worked, funnily enough, as long as they didn't debase their currency. And now this is where we'll go swiftly into the printing money model. But for now, I just wanted to mention one more quote, which says, and this is a quote from Ron Paul, one of the United States, Congress members. "Because gold is honest money, it is disliked by dishonest men." Food for thought. We'll come back to that. So, as you might remember from The Price of Tomorrow book by Jeff Booth, which I'll link below as well, deflation is a natural state of free market economy. Okay? So, according to the idea that we're always choosing things that are better for us, and we're always making things better, more efficient, and therefore cheaper over time, in a natural state of economy, if there was no one manipulating any levers of economy, if we were to simply let it be, you would see deflation of prices, meaning the prices of things would fall over time. So, you know, if you're earning 100,000 a year in a job, in a healthy economy, I would argue, in an economy that is based on a good monetary, on good money, essentially, in a healthy money economy, you would find that a year after, you might not get a raise, but your money will be buying you more that year than the year before. Where unfortunately, currently, that's not the case. And if you think that's the case, please think again. Like, stop this video right now, go outside, talk with people, and maybe get yourself some sort of sources. I've been suggesting some over the past weeks to understand that inflation is exactly the opposite of that. If anyone mentions any sort of inflation of price, what that effectively means is that your money is just worth less. There is less value to be offered through that same £100,000 that you might be earning. So a very big point that you will see across the book, and this is basically the message of it, is on a gold standard, on a gold money standard, prices were falling. People were living better, not making much more effort. You didn't have to hustle, out-trade, speculate to make your ends meet. You know, 100 years ago, a family of 9, meaning a man and a woman and 7 children, they would be able to maintain that family with one of them working and one of them staying at home, regardless who that was. Nowadays, it's pretty much impossible. You know, I've literally just had a conversation about it with my friends today at work, that mostly due to financial issue, people are less likely to have many kids simply because it's a cost, right? And if you cannot make your ends meet, it's very difficult to imagine that you can make your ends meet while trying to support 3, 4, 10 children. Whereas I'm pretty sure that as majority of my friends, their grandparents, such as your grandparents, potentially had more siblings. I wouldn't be surprised. And of course, you know, there are many more differences in our life versus the life from before. But one major difference, and this is certainly a huge difference since 1971, when Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard, effectively rendering the whole of the global economy unrelated to any sort of hard money of any kind, is that it is more and more difficult to have as many kids. It is more and more difficult to stay afloat because your money is losing value. Now that I had a little rant about it, let's look at the other side. Because of course, you know, the book in major part is about the history of gold, but it wouldn't really be useful to us, apart from maybe an entertainment, asset, if there wasn't some sort of a conclusion or at least a suggestion of things to consider that might be related to our day and age. And of course, Dominic Frisbee does not omit to do that. So in terms of printing money, okay, what I mean by money printing? Well, of course, it can be physically printing money because you might have banknotes in your wallet. And if you do, that money was printed, right? Especially if it's paper. But printing money effectively, I will refer broadly to generating, producing money meaning a unit of account, a trading token, a technology that we use to trade with one another, to exchange energy and value. But it doesn't necessarily have to be printed. Of course, in our day and age, majority of money printing is simply clicking a few zeros on an Excel spreadsheet and clicking enter, right? You don't need to physically print money to make money show up out of thin air. And if you think about it, it's even more cost efficient not to print, simply just to click it on Excel. So, fun fact about printing money, the first recorded example of money printing occurred in Mongolia, And it was created during Kublai Khan's rule. So this gentleman, probably with a crew of his ministers, came up with an ingenious idea that he can issue promissory notes. You know, a banknote is a note from the bank. It's an IOU. I owe you something for this note. A promissory note. And he would issue them to pay for his expenses, for the army and for everything. He would pay for his imports to the country while importing gold, silver and other more hard money, you know, closer to hard money items than printed money. And of course, as every case of printing money, it worked for some time. He certainly managed to acquire a lot of the world's wealth before they realized that they are being scammed. But then, unfortunately, since the way the system of printing money is designed, there is only more debt to be created. There is no way back. As Lynn Alden often says, nothing stops this train. For this, I'll link below the episode about Lynn's book that we've discussed literally a week or two ago. And so what happens there is at some point, you know, once everyone realizes that you're not actually gonna give them back the money that you've promised them, there is a bank run, meaning usually, you know, in a physical sense, it would be literally people standing outside of your bank expecting to be paid for all their IOUs that they have. Of course, it doesn't necessarily happen that way. But what effectively happened is the empire, you know, and imploded onto itself. And by now there's little history. You know, it is simply history by now, right? Who knows? Maybe if the Mongolian Empire stayed an empire and didn't debase its currency, maybe instead of China ruling that part of the world, it would be Mongolian Empire right now. Who knows? You know, this is just... that's how history works, right? History is written by the victors. And so, you know, over time, if you take away from yourself the foundation, your castle collapses. It's you know, it's even in the scripture, right? To build your house upon rock and not sand. So so of course, that's a little fun fact. You know, an example a bit closer to home, maybe the Roman Empire. If you know the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, you know, there are many arguments to be said about the fall of the Roman Empire. But the one thing that people seem to omiss, maybe on purpose, maybe we are not really pointed in that direction simply because it would suggest where our Western economy might be going, is that the Romans over time as the government grew and expenses grew and they, you know, their conquest slowed and the mines ran out of gold, started coin clipping. It literally means to clip. You know, it was a sort of a tax. You would come into Rome, and every time you enter Rome, there is a gentleman on the door that just clips a little bit of your coin. And over time, of course, what that created is that inflation came into play, right? Because if a gold coin is supposed to be supposed to be an ounce, but then because of coin clipping, suddenly an ounce coin actually weighs a quarter of an ounce, then what effectively happened is you have a 75% increase in money supply, right? So, you know, the funny little quote here, of course, is how easy it is to be generous with giving away money that can be printed at no expense. And Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, who's one of the Austrian economists, And for Austrian economy, I would definitely recommend you rewatch the episode about praxeology, the book by Knut Svanholm. I hope that at some point Knut's gonna show up on the show to share more on his perspectives. But Friedrich Hayek said this: practically all governments of history have used their exclusive power to issue money to defraud and plunder their own people. Now, before we go deeper into the whole money printing, I just wanted to ask you this, because I had a conversation about this with my friend lately. Do you remember when you were a kid, or maybe you still are, and good for you if you are listening to this still being fairly young, you're way ahead of the crowd if you do. Do you remember when your parents gave you your lunch money, for example? Do you remember maybe if your parents said like, oh, you know, spend as much as you want, as much as you need, and just give us the rest, right? What that reminds me of is a budget that maybe your local or national government has. Now, do you remember how easy it was to use that money? Can you compare it with how easy it is for you to spend your money now that you've earned it? Maybe because you work as a barista at a cafe, or maybe you're an accountant, maybe you're running your own business, whatever. Can you tell the difference? Is there any difference between spending your own money or spending money that is not yours, you've not worked for it, and then worst of all, if you don't spend it, it will be taken away from you. Now, this is effectively what the government is dealing with. The government in and of itself has no money. It's not a productive organization. It's not that they mine money, right? What they do is, in collaboration with your central bank, your national bank, they set the budget. Budget meaning, you know, an amount of expenditure that the government will use over the year, or, you know, a few years or whatever. And then if they don't use that budget, then the year after, someone might say, well, you've not used all your budget last year, so obviously it was not necessary, so this year we're gonna offer you smaller budget. Of course, this is just an example, because as you know, in practice, if you've looked at governmental budgets over the past, let's say, 30 years, you know that there is little to no case to be made at governmental budgets shrinking, right? They tend to grow, if anything. Now, let's come back to this idea. How generous can one be with printing money that is, you know, printed out of nothing? If it takes me 3 hours to earn enough to keep, you know, to take me and my wife for dinner, I will know the value of that dinner, and maybe I'll choose to not go for dinner and use a second best option, order, you know, takeaway, and save some money for later, right? Because I am the sole, it was my energy that was expended to get that money, and it is my energy that I'm storing if I keep it for later. It was not government's energy to print the money, and it is not government's problem to save it. Effectively, if you remember from The Price of Tomorrow and what we've discussed with Paul on the episode, and other ideas of such, all of the other 9 episodes from this season are certainly relevant. The government is effectively taking your money out of your savings by clipping your coin. And of course, they are not doing it anymore by physically clipping coins. They simply do it by clicking enter on a spreadsheet. And this is, it's not only the government, it's the central bank and it's the local banks, it's everyone. Every time there is credit issued, whether on a debt or on a loan, maybe you are planning to buy yourself a house and you're going to take out credit. What that interest rate is on your credit account, that is free money. That is money being printed out of thin air. That is money being taken away from everyone who has savings and distributed among those that are issuing it. It's the Cantillon effect, if you remember, which is effectively this phenomena that whoever is the closest to the money printer benefits from printing and whoever is the furthest pays the most, right? So it's usually, unfortunately, the working class, the middle class that are paying, that are footing the bill. And everyone, everyone around the money printer is benefiting. So one outrageous, not really fun fact that the author points out to is that, you know, in the inflation rate, which is being supposedly aimed to be kept at 2% per year, it's actually a part of the policy from central banks that they are aiming for 2% inflation year on year, which is due to the Keynesian economics, which is complete madness. But, you know, dive deeper into that if you want. Austrian School of Economics is an alternative that is certainly much more, I think, up reasonable street. apparently, according to the author, in the calculation of the inflation rate, money supply is not even considered. Think just how absurd this is. If we know that inflation comes primarily from more money being printed, then how come we're not accounting for money being printed when we're trying to assess how much inflation there is in the market? Similarly, the basket of goods that is being used to calculate that CPI, which is the inflation index effectively for the year, we're not using some of the goods in that basket. For example, we're not taking into account the prices of housing in inflation calculations, even though it's essential, right? What is more essential than a place to live? Like, tell me, apart from your ability to breathe and ability to, you know, drink some water, eat, shelter is there. It's one of the most essential things, and yet it's not considered in the calculation. Why? Well, maybe because it's so great, if it was considered, that it would be just simply outrageous, right? And you can look up and try to figure out for yourself, don't take my word for it, what is the real rate of inflation in your country? And I don't know what it is, but I'm pretty sure it's not zero, and I'm pretty sure it's not 2%. You know, to drive this point home, to make it even worse, and I don't, like, this is not here to discourage you. We'll go in a second into the practical applications of what the author offers, but and my own reflections, but I asked this to my friends at work today, and none of them guessed, and I wouldn't have guessed either. Guess how much money there is in circulation in terms of cash in the Western world broadly. Let's consider United States, and dollars. What is the percentage of dollars that is actually represented by cash versus the whole market value, market capitalization of dollars in the world, meaning all of the credit debt dollars out there? Apparently it's 1%. So in the whole of the world, there is 1% of cash dollars, and 99% of dollars is not even physically a banknote. That just shows how easy it is, effectively for free, to print money, and how pernicious this idea is. Because if there is no cost to printing money, then whoever is printing money is the wealthiest person of them all, and whoever is trying to earn that money, with each day the money is being printed, is being robbed from their effort, right? Both in saving and both in earning. Because if you consider that inflation is on 2% per year, let's assume for the sake of argument that it is only 2%, then unless year on year you don't earn 2% more, you're earning less in real terms year on year. And that's just the supposed target inflation. And of course, we know that inflation is much higher than that, especially in times of, you know, war and COVID or whatever. So yeah, what do we do about it? I've just thrown at you a bunch of ideas there, and not necessarily pleasant ones, I understand. But definitely read the book. It's incredible. Now, to the point, what is the practical application? What can we learn from what author is offering in The Secret History of Gold? So, first and foremost, there is no need to trust anyone with your gold if you hold it for yourself. We know that on average, there is roughly 2% year-on-year supply of gold being mined, meaning that on average, year-on-year, inflation in gold supply will be 2%. But this is not something that someone promises or assumes. It's something that stems from the practical excavation of gold. It's just, it takes effort, it takes energy, it takes tools, it takes capital to extract gold, to find it, to, you know, to mine it, right? So just because of it, if you are considering saving long term, saving in hard money, hard meaning more difficult to be debased, more difficult to be inflated, more difficult to be destroyed. And as we know from earlier, gold is one of the hardest things to destroy in the universe. Investing in physical gold or physical silver, physical commodity, which is less likely to be printed, you are more likely to maintain the purchasing power of your money. There is this famous comparison that roughly 100 years ago, it cost an ounce of gold to buy yourself a really nice suit in the United States. Now, currently, for an ounce of gold, you can roughly buy yourself a really nice suit in the United States. The difference is, though, if you were to keep the value of that gold in dollars back in 100 years ago, and then use that same amount of dollars to buy yourself a suit this, you know, 100 years later, it's pretty much impossible. Please do the maths for you. Look it up. I don't remember exact, you know, numbers, so I don't want to confuse you here or lie to you. Now, this is to maintain the purchasing power. This is to hedge against inflation. This is to not be on the mercy of the merciless, the generous printers of the money out there. And they are very generous simply because they're not the ones footing the bill. Please remember the example of a child, you as a child taking money from your parents to spend on lunch. Something that I've only recently realized is that people don't know that they can buy physical gold and physical silver, and they don't know even more so, that in some countries, in some jurisdictions, such as in the UK, if you buy silver or gold coins that are minted in the country, so for example, for I have here a Canadian silver maple leaf, yeah? So if you can see here, if I was in Canada, I don't know, I assume it's similar. Well, I'll just say how it is here. So in the UK, if you buy a UK minted silver coin, for example, if you were to sell it in the UK, maybe in 2, 3, 5, 10 years time, that capital gains is tax-free. So the gain that you made on this trade of buying it and then selling it is tax-free. So there are even incentives in place to encourage people to buy those things. Similarly, in China, there was a huge, I don't know if it still is, but there was a huge campaign in China, which was mentioned by the author, which was focused on encouraging people to buy gold, Chinese mined gold, and store it for themselves, to invest in gold. And China, apparently, according to the author, and not only, has been one of the greatest importer and miner of gold over the past 50, 70 years. Russia is up there. From what I remember, there's South Africa, plenty of gold mined there. The point here is that not only maybe you've not known that you can do this, and maybe you've not known that you can do it to optimize your tax efficiency, because effectively if something is tax-free, then you don't have to pay tax on it, so you're more tax efficient, right? But the difference here is that this little coin, you know, this is maybe £40 worth, whatever. It is unlikely that over the course of the next, 5 years, this will lose 2%, 5%, 8% of value. If it does, so be it. It didn't change in its essence. So over time, you will see that you might just have to wait a little longer, but there is no fundamental reason for it to lose value. Now, the other side of this coin, pun intended, is if you keep it in your printed dollars, pounds, yuans, whatever you name it, if the central bank is promising to keep the inflation at 2% year on year, then compounding effect will make in 20 years time your savings account worth half of the amount it actually is. So even though in quantity you might still be holding $100,000 on your account, in quality the value of those dollars will be $50,000 after 20 years. This is the compounding effect we don't understand, and this is the fight that we're in. And I'm not talking about like fighting with anyone. This is the fight with time. This is the fight with, you know, yourself against time. If you don't want to be making money, constantly working 9 to 5 till the day you die, you need to figure out a way to store your energy, to make your money work for you, or at least to not lose value over time. And this is where technology such as physical gold, physical silver, which have been with us for, you know, millennia, Bitcoin, and for that, please refer to the episode on Bitcoin I've linked below. These technologies are hedging against inflation. They are naturally anti-inflation in their essence. And of course, as I mentioned before, there is an inflation of gold supply, but it's nowhere near as bad as the inflation of your dollar, of your pound, of your zloty, of your euro. And this is something to get you thinking. This is not the same than as buying an ETF, an exchange-traded fund on an exchange. This is something that you can physically hold. I believe there is a big power in self-custody of those things, meaning you're the custodian of it. You're not being promised anything from anyone. If you lose it, it's yours to lose. If you keep it safe, it's yours to keep safe. And anyone can afford it, you know, and it's, you know, tax efficient, that, as I said. So I would encourage you to educate yourself on this idea, and I would encourage you to read the book, because I understand that, you know, as we've explored Bitcoin before, Bitcoin is the one technology that the author mentions, but it's the one technology that is very difficult for people to comprehend to begin with. And I understand that the curve for learning about Bitcoin is rather steep, and for the time being, many people will not want to explore that. But the learning curve for silver or the learning curve for gold is not that steep, and it's, you have thousands of years of proof that people used gold and silver as an important money technology component in their civilization. So there's certainly something to it. And while I am a big fan of Bitcoin, and I do believe it is worth your while to educate yourself on that as well, I would implore you to educate yourself on the idea of gold and silver, and the idea of treating that as hard money, and understanding what would that mean for the world if we were on a gold standard. It's really difficult to imagine to begin with, because no one, as the author pointed out, no one living currently remembers the time before. There is no one left that remembers how it was to be fully on a gold standard, because the gold standard, step by step, was dismantled in the 18th century. It's quite a while back. So, yeah. And, you know, the difference here, something for you to consider, is that you can either speculate in this environment where everyone needs to become a hedge fund manager, an investment specialist and whatnot, because they need to maintain their value of their currency. Or you can invest, you can buy assets, you can buy hard money that is unlikely to be printed out of thin air. And, you know, please refer to the episode with Paul where we've discussed that houses are not investments. What you experience as a house owner, seeing that your house has gone up in price, is the inflation taking effect. Of course, maybe because of the developments in your area, your house is worth more than before, so be it. But as a baseline, a house is a thing you use. It is actually depreciating. It is losing value over time. Only because we live in a system that is inherently broken can you see price of the house go up while you're using it, and you're spilling your drinks over it, and you're breaking the window, and your kid is drawing with crayons on the wall, and all that. Just think about it. It's very simple once you crack the code, let's say. So yeah, one fun fact about credit: it comes from Italian credire, meaning to trust, to believe. You're the one to decide whether or not you trust those that issue credit to you. And the quote that I promised you is this one: to touch gold is as closest as you'll ever come to touching eternity. Gold is older than the universe. Dominic Frisby. So, yeah, I think that's a good moment to, good place to stop. So, my invitation for you for this week and my encouragement is get yourself out there, educate yourself, explore those ideas that we've discussed over the past months, read those books, or at least review what we've discussed and, you know, look it up yourself. You have all the tools in your phone effectively to explore those ideas. And I would really encourage you to take charge of your financial health and future. No one else is there to, you know, help you. It is you against you. It is you against time. And time will win over time anyway, but you can make yourself stronger, right? And you can safeguard your family. You can safeguard your children's children. You can create generational wealth if you play your cards right. And as I said, anyone can afford this. The, you know, a silver coin nowadays is like 40, 50 pounds. Of course, gold will be more expensive and so on, but these are not things that are out of your reach. And these are things that might actually in your jurisdiction be something also tax efficient. So look that up. This is no financial advice. It's just a friendly chatter. But yeah, you know, this is an invitation for you to explore those ideas because we've done a full season on the topic, on the theme of finance, money and economy. I will go to another theme now. I don't know exactly which one. I have to check my schedule, but I will let you take hold of your financial education from now on. We'll maybe be back with some other episodes later on, but for now that's pretty much it. So make sure, please, if you haven't already, subscribe, follow, maybe join Fountain FM and join the chat there and send me a message. If you'd like to support the podcast in any other way, follow the link below, maybe buy me a coffee, maybe send me an email, maybe don't do any of these things and just listen on. I appreciate you greatly, and yeah, may you be wealthy, and may your family and your children's children benefit from this action you've taken today. So yeah, have a wonderful, wonderful week. Stay happy, stay healthy, and I'll see you next time.